Hello, I'm Maria Titizian.
And I'm Rubina Margosyan, and this is The Week in Review.
Every week, we bring you the stories shaping Armenia and the region.
From politics and policy to social issues and conflict, we break down the news and what it means for you.
This week in the news, Baku ramps up so-called Zangezur Corridor rhetoric. Armenian and Azerbaijani diplomats meet in Ankara and Tbilisi. Pashinyan continues to push peace agenda, and Vartan Khugasyan becomes Gyumri's mayor again. These stories and more in our weekly roundup of the news.
The deputy foreign ministers of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia held their first ever trilateral meeting in the Georgian capital this week. In a joint press statement, the parties emphasized the untapped potential for cooperation among the three South Caucasus countries, grounded in full respect for each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The meeting sought to promote trilateral cooperation in areas of mutual interest, with the overarching goal of fostering sustainable growth and prosperity across the region. Strengthening collaboration in these domains could help address shared challenges and contribute to long-term stability and development in the region. It also provided a platform for an open exchange of ideas and perspectives on possible avenues for cooperation. The meeting is regarded as an initial phase designed to build trust and pave the way for the eventual advancement of the dialogue to a higher level.
Azerbaijan continues to keep tensions high on the border. Early this week, Armenia's defense ministry reported that Azerbaijani forces had opened fire toward the village of Khanadzakh in the Sunik region over the weekend. The village's cultural center was damaged in the incident. No casualties were reported. The ministry called on Azerbaijan to investigate the shelling and issue a public explanation. It also reiterated that Yerevan has proposed creating a joint Armenia-Azerbaijan mechanism to investigate ceasefire violations and related incidents, an initiative that Baku has yet to respond to. Meanwhile, in the Davush region, residents of the village of Mofses also reported hearing gunfire this week, and the border in that area is usually, you know, quiet and calm. And just as a reminder, 12 kilometers of a stretch along that border were demarcated last May.
And the French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot expressed concern over rising tensions along the Armenia-Azerbaijan border. He said he hoped the European monitoring mission on the ground could be expanded to help observe and contain the situation. Barrot also stressed the need to finalize the peace treaty and called for the release of prisoners, referring to them as arbitrarily detained. The following day, Barrot held a phone call with Armenian Foreign Minister Arat Mirzoyan and reiterated France's continued support for Armenia's sovereignty and resilience.
During a panel discussion featuring the foreign ministers of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia at the Antalya Diplomacy Forum over the weekend, Azerbaijan's foreign minister, Ceyhun Bayramov, reiterated Baku's position regarding what it calls the Zangezur Corridor, a proposed route that would link mainland Azerbaijan to its Nakhichevan exclave by passing through Armenia's Sunik region, and which Azerbaijan insists should operate under its own terms. Bayramov stressed the importance of having firm guarantees for unimpeded access, saying Azerbaijan does not want to find itself in a situation where it agrees to something only to see the terms reversed a year or two later due to changes in Armenia's legislation or a shift in political power. He pointed to the early days of the conflict when the Nakhichevan Autonomous Republic, as he put it, became a hostage of geopolitical reality. For Baku, ensuring that this transit route remains unaffected by future political developments in Armenia is a key priority. Bayramov also reiterated Baku's demands regarding changes to the Armenian constitution and the dissolution of the OSCE Minsk group.
Bayramov and Mirzoyan also held bilateral talks on the sidelines of the conference. In nearly identical statements, the foreign ministers of both countries said they had discussed the current state of normalization process following the finalization of peace agreement text. Both ministers reaffirmed their readiness to continue the dialogue, while in Antalya, Mirzoyan also met with Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan. Similar to the meeting with Bayramov, press statements were brief, noting only that the two ministers discussed current issues on the Armenia-Turkey bilateral agenda. No concrete progress was announced on pending agreements, including opening of the border to third country citizens and diplomatic passport holders, assessing the Gyumri-Kars railway, or restoring the historic Ani Bridge, which are things that Armenia and Turkey have been talking about in the last several years. In a later interview with Turkish media, Mirzoyan expressed confidence that both sides share a common understanding. The ultimate goal is full normalization of relations, the establishment of diplomatic ties, and the complete opening of the border. He noted that talks with Vidan also touched on broader opportunities that could support this normalization process. According to Mirzoyan, Armenia-Turkey dialogue isn't only about opening the border or establishing diplomatic relations as standalone goals, but about unlocking larger-scale trade, something he sees as a real opportunity for both countries. The two ministers also discussed joint energy projects and regional transit prospects. Mirzoyan added that they even explored cooperation on international platforms, pointing out that on certain issues, particularly concerning the Middle East, Armenia and Turkey may actually share closer perspectives than expected.
In what feels like a constant back and forth between Yerevan and Baku over Azerbaijan's demands for signing the peace agreement, specifically altering Armenia's constitution, dissolving the OSCE Minsk group, as we said above, Prime Minister Pashinyan responded yet again. This time he clarified that Armenia has proposed signing the peace agreement and dissolving the Minsk group simultaneously. The aim is to dispel fears that such a move could signal a shift in the conflict from Nagorno-Karabakh to Armenia's own territory. Addressing the demands for constitutional change, Pashinyan pointed out that Armenia's constitutional court has already ruled that the peace process based on the Alma-Ata Declaration fully complies with the country's constitution. This ruling was issued in regards to the regulation on the joint work of the border commissions. He further explained that even if Armenia's constitution included territorial claims against Azerbaijan, the peace treaty once signed would override it. According to Armenian legislation, international treaties take precedence over domestic laws. And despite rising tensions and daily ceasefire violations by Azerbaijani forces, Pashinyan emphasized that Armenia will stay committed to its peace agenda. He reiterated that there is no justification for war and once again called for a joint mechanism to investigate border incidents. He said, there will be no war, there will be peace.
And during his closing remarks following a Q&A session in Parliament, Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan once again reiterated that Armenia has no territorial claims against Azerbaijan and laid out his vision for the development of Armenia and the region. He said the Karabakh movement must not continue in Armenia, calling it a tool that has long been used to undermine the country's independence and statehood. Pashinyan emphasized that the core mission of his government is to build and strengthen Armenian statehood, something he said still faces deep-rooted challenges. Even after 34 years of independence, he argued that Armenia's independence was initially framed around solving the Karabakh conflict. And coming to power in 2018, he and his team came to the conclusion that the Karabakh movement, which is the movement of the people that unity between Armenia and Karabakh, and then self-determination for Karabakh. Well, this Karabakh movement, he said, in effect had ended, and continuing to frame national politics around it, he argued, only serves to weaken Armenia's sovereignty. Instead, he said, Armenia should no longer be seen as a tool for liberation struggles, but should be a country focused on ensuring the freedom, prosperity, and security of its citizens within its internationally recognized 29,743 square kilometers. He stressed that the foundation of a strong Armenian state lies in economic development. Only with sustained growth can the country provide its people with security, health, justice, and freedom, and that in turn requires peace and the rule of law. He also spoke about the need for a new way of thinking, one that sees Armenia not just as a symbolic homeland in the region, but as a functioning sovereign state that shapes its own future. Declaring that peace, not war, is Armenia's path forward, Pashinyan called on political forces in both Armenia and Azerbaijan to act responsibly and avoid rhetoric that undermines core principles such as territorial integrity, the inviolability of Soviet-era borders, non-interference in domestic affairs, and the rejection of force. He stated that Armenia's government will remain committed to this logic and urged Azerbaijan's government to do the same. He also once again stressed that there are no remaining obstacles to signing the peace agreement. In his words, the region should no longer anticipate escalation or war, only peace. And he concluded by saying that the same principles guiding peace with Azerbaijan also shape Armenia's broader regional policy. According to Pashinyan, only by fully recognizing the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of neighboring countries can Armenia expect the same in return. That, he said, is the essence of statehood and the transformation his administration continues to pursue.
Well, at the same time, Pashinyan told reporters during a briefing that Armenia's new constitution should not reference the Declaration of Independence. He noted that in his addresses marking Independence Declaration Day between 2022 and 2024, he had revisited the document and came to the conclusion that, and this is in his view, it implies that the establishment of an independent Armenian state and statehood may not be feasible. This is according to Pashinyan. Analysis of the declaration. Still, he emphasized that the final decision of a new constitution would rest with the people of Armenia. He also said that Armenia has sent new written proposals to Azerbaijan regarding the border delimitation process, outlining how and where the process could continue. But as of now, Azerbaijan has not responded. And as we mentioned a little bit earlier in the podcast, a 12-kilometer section of the Armenia-Azerbaijan border in the Davush region was delimited in May last year. And back in January, the border commissions had agreed to begin the next phase of the delimitation process from the northernmost point, where the borders of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia actually meet, and to continue southward, all the way to the point where the Armenia-Azerbaijan border meets Iran. But so far, we have not heard anything about any kind of movement in that regard.
And meanwhile, in Brussels, Armenia Security Council Secretary Armen Grigorian met with Andrius Kubilius, the European Commissioner for Defense Affairs. The two discussed ways to strengthen bilateral cooperation in defense and the military industry. Grigorian shared details about the Armenian government's ongoing efforts to develop the sector and outlined its main priorities. Kubilius, in turn, presented the EU's own priorities when it comes to defense and arms production, along with an action plan based on its broader strategic goals.
And Azazutyun reported this week, citing its diplomatic sources, that Hungary is once again blocking an EU funding package for Armenia under the European Peace Facility. Brussels intends to allocate 20 million euros to Armenia on top of the 10 million euros it provided last year, again, within the European Peace Facility. Hungary had blocked that first allocation as well, demanding similar assistance for Azerbaijan. After months of closed-door negotiations, Hungary eventually lifted its veto and Armenia received the funding. During a joint press conference with his Slovenian counterpart Tanja Fajon in Yerevan, Foreign Minister Arat Mirzoyan confirmed that discussions on the 20 million euro package are ongoing, expressing hope for a positive resolution. Fajon emphasized that Slovenia supports the allocation. And, you know, just as a reminder, Hungary and Azerbaijan have very, very warm relations with one another. Orban has, been a strong supporter of Aliyev and vice versa. So let's see if Armenia will be able to get over this hurdle. And we published an article by Sosi Tatikyan called European Peace Facility's First Assistance Measure for Armenia, Rationale and Significance. It's a very interesting sort of background or an information about the peace facility.
Yes, how we applied first and it was denied, the European Union didn't accept, and then how it was on the agenda and, you know, Orban was basically vetoing it.
Yeah.
On April 16, Armenia voted yes on a UN General Assembly resolution entitled Cooperation between the United Nations and the Council of Europe, which, among other things, recognizes that the unprecedented unprecedented challenges now facing Europe following the aggression by Russia against Ukraine and against Georgia called for strengthened cooperation between the United Nations and the Council of Europe. Only 9 countries voted against the resolution, including Russia, Belarus, North Korea, and the U.S. Why is this kind of interesting in our context? Since the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine, Armenia has repeatedly abstained from UN votes on Ukraine. Prior to the invasion, Armenia backed Russia for years, especially on Crimea. Most recently, on the 3rd anniversary of the Russian invasion, Armenia again abstained.
Right, so there's a clear change, obviously, in their policy there.
And we do have another article on the way Armenia has historically voted in the UN and how that has changed.
And always on Russia's side, before. Well, in local news this week, the controversial mayor, former mayor of Gyumri, Vartan Khugasyan, was elected as mayor of Gyumri, securing 18 out of the 33 votes in the city council. The civil contract faction, which is the ruling party, boycotted the session, and their candidate, Sarik Minasyan, has called for new snap elections, saying that it's in the best interest of the city and its residents. But this obviously has fallen on deaf ears because the opposition rallied behind Vartan Khugasyan, who's, I think we spoke about this last week probably, who's notorious for his outbursts against women, other minorities. He's called for the burning of LGBTQ people and
shooting a priest at church if there's ever a gay wedding.
He's been involved in shootouts. His son has been involved in many criminal cases.
We have all of that in writing in one of these articles, right, which we'll talk about later when we're summing up what we published this week.
And meanwhile, in the town of Parakar, opposition candidate Volodya Grigoryan was elected mayor. A civil contract boycotted that vote as well.
And this week, Artsakh's parliament in exile adopted a constitutional amendment allowing it to either extend the president's term or elect a new one without holding a public vote. The amendment is meant to preserve the institution of the presidency and ensure the continuity of state institutions. Well, Samver Shahramanian, the last president of Artsakh, his term in office ends in May, or would have ended in May had it still been in office, but it remains unclear whether how this vote or the election will be held, or if
by whom.
We're assuming only at this point, on going on the information that we have, that the cabinet will elect him.
Well, Artsakh Armenians, led by the Council for the Protection of the Rights of Artsakh Armenians, continued to protest, calling on the Armenian government to reinstate aid for rent and utilities, review the housing program, end hate speech directed at Artsakh Armenians, and keep their right of return on the national agenda. Following a third meeting between Deputy Prime Minister Dikran Khachaturian and the council members, the government signaled its willingness to extend the 40,000 dirham rent support for 2 more months, but not the additional 10,000 dirhams for utility payments. The aid program was discontinued on April 1. Officials also said they're open to forming expert groups to discuss broader issues, including social and housing programs. The council is expected to issue a public statement about its next steps in the coming days. And as always, we talk briefly about the articles that we published this week. Today we published a piece by our staff writer Hovhannes Nazaretyan. It's called The Power and Politics of Yerevan's Statues. You know, after reading the piece, Roop, I didn't realize how many statues we actually have. I mean, I know that we have a lot of statues, but
we might have some of the higher numbers per capita.
Per capita, probably. Well, so he writes that, you know, these statues and their placement, the timing, they reveal shifting political ideologies and national identity, you know, from Soviet heroes during Soviet era to national figures, international allies, and symbolic women, because there's only really 2 or 3 named statues for actual women. The rest are just generic forms of, you know, a woman and a jug or whatever it is. And so he explores how public monuments reflect power, memory, and Armenia's evolving historical and geopolitical narratives.
And Maria, not very characteristic of us. We've had a week that's talked about a lot about culture,
right? Yeah, which is nice, actually.
which is nice. We've had a first-time contributor, Ani Bogosyan. Her article's called "Dreams Against Empire: Paragon of Cinematic Defiance," and it was the 102nd anniversary of Armenian cinema this week. So this was published on that occasion, and it's a poetic exploration of filmmaker Sergei Parajanov's radical defiance against Soviet conformity. The author traces his visionary cinema rooted in Armenian identity and artistic freedom, and how it challenged the empire, celebrating cultural memory, and how it outlived the system that sought to silence him. And there's a very interesting Ukraine connection there.
Yes, a Georgian-Ukraine connection. But he found his voice in the Armenian identity. It was a beautifully written piece, and I'm looking forward to more articles by Ani. And we also publish another really fascinating piece by Talin Ungyan called Pinar Selek's Intellectual Journey of Resistance. Ungyan traces the intellectual and political journey of Pinar Selek, who is a Turkish feminist and anti-militarist persecuted by the state, whose work on structural violence, memory, and the Armenian genocide offers really powerful insights into resistance, identity, and forgotten histories. And, you know, she was jailed for a number of years for an alleged bombing that she had nothing to do with in Turkey. And now she lives abroad, unfortunately, I guess, or fortunately for her.
Many intellectuals under...
And she talks about this in the piece, that, you know, is geography important, that, you know, these existences that the Turkish exiles have abroad connects them in ways that, and allows them to have a voice in a way that they wouldn't have had they stayed in Turkey.
Finally got around to publishing a piece in English that we'd had in Armenian for a while. It's a series that one of our contributors, Astrid Karapetyan, has done on a situation behind bars in jails in Armenia. Mm-hmm. Her first one that we had in English was Motherhood Behind Bars, and this time she's looking at work and education, and it's titled Behind Bars, of course, Work and Education as a Lifeline.
Yeah, it was a very interesting piece for me as well to see how, you know, some inmates take advantage of the opportunity to continue their education and to try and get work so that they ease the burden on their families, because, you know, sometimes the families have to buy them whatever they need, from medicine to clothes and things. So it was actually a really interesting piece. And then we had our column by Olesya Vartanyan, Beyond Borders. And I really, I enjoyed all of the articles. It's called Armenia's Quiet Defiance. And she looks at, you know, this rising authoritarianism in Georgia and the one that exists in Azerbaijan, and how Armenia stands as this fragile, you know, outlier almost of democratic pluralism. And she looks at whether can Armenia withstand this regional tide of repression, or if pluralism is the country's final safeguard for resilience. So it was, again, a very thought-provoking piece.
With this column. Mm-hmm. And as we said earlier in the podcast, we do have a piece on who the Gyumri mayor is and the life he's had so far. And it's called Deja Vu in Gyumri, Controversial Former Mayor Returns. It's in our NewsWatch section, where we also have another article that kind of looks into the elections in general and the process, which we will keep updating if there are any news in the future.
Right, and that's the kind of week it's been here in Armenia. Thank you for listening. Have a safe and peaceful weekend, and we will be back next week.